Welcome to The Leadership Mindset, the podcast where we uncover the hidden gems of sales and business leadership. In each episode, our goal is to bring you up close and personal with the world's most accomplished business leaders. We explore their experiences, motivations, inspirations, and the challenges they've conquered on their way to the top. In today's episode, you can expect to learn about the challenges and opportunities presented by remote working environments for sales professionals, the importance of diversity in leadership to foster innovation, and the strategies for overcoming gender-specific challenges in sales careers with today's guest, Maura Brady.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'd like to ask you, Maura, your name. Yesterday was St. Patrick's Day as of recording this. And it's not just your surname, but your first name also is very Irish. So I'm guessing there's a story there.
Both of my parents' family traces back to Ireland. I've got Donnelly on my mom's side, Brady on my dad's side. Maura, I think, was just a name they liked. Truthfully, not a family name, but my middle name is another surname that's Irish. So a lot of pride on this side for sure.
Well, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Maine, actually. My parents, I think it's three generations back, perhaps, I came over. So part of the immigration over to the Northeast, my family's all from the New England area. But my dad is a professor who moved up to Maine before I was born. So I was actually the only one in my family who's a true Mainer. But it was a great place to grow up.
It's a beautiful state. I've been there a couple of times, and I'm trying to think. Lake Winnipesaukee. I don't think that in Maine.
That's in New Hampshire.
New Hampshire. That was the state. But you traveled through Maine to get to New Hampshire, right?
Yes.
And just an incredible part of the country. Really beautiful.
So, it's gorgeous. I didn't appreciate it growing up, but now love to go back. Definitely call there is one of kind.
What are some of your early childhood memories that you cherish growing up?
Oh boy, I was the youngest, so I did a lot of getting carted around to sporting events. We were a big baseball family, so spent a lot of hours and nights at the local fields and playing sandlot and all of that fun stuff. Yeah, it was great to grow up with a lot of family around. My mom was one of seven, so we had a lot of cousins, big Irish Catholic family, so a lot of laughs, a lot of fun times.
Mm-hmm. And how do you think that might have prepared you for a life in sales?
Yeah, good at going with the punches, for sure. I like to tell people, my mom actually had a daycare growing up where she stayed at home to watch my brother and sister. But by the time I came around, she was ready to get back into the working world. So at a young age, I went to daycare myself. And I think that is what I attribute to being social and outgoing and having a good immune system. So I'm a big proponent for getting kids into daycare early. And yeah, I think that just helped me grow thick skin, get a lot of confidence, and learn to work with others.
There may be something in that. There's a great book called Birth Order, where the author looks at the characteristics of people based on where in the family line they're born, whether the eldest child or the youngest. And it's quite interesting. Yes, there's a lot of generalities, but they often play out as truisms as well, particularly with the younger ones who are left sometimes to fend for themselves. And sometimes they have the older siblings can be part parents as well, because they're often left minding them when the parents are busy doing something else. And it's interesting. I think this in Hollywood, they're saying a lot of the actors, the youngest child, because they get a lot of attention.
Yeah.
I say that I was youngest child myself for a long time until my sister came along 5 years later and took that away from me. But so I can see some of that in it. It's like the parents are paranoid with the eldest child, and then the others come along and it's, Eva, me be fine. She'll be fine.
My mom likes to say with my brother, who was the first, if he dropped his pacifier on the ground, she'd boil water. With my sister, it would get under running water. And by the time it came to me, she'd just blow on it and put it right back in my mouth. She was, at that point, was definitely a lot more laid back when it came to raising me and giving me a little bit more independence and freedom to explore.
Mm-hmm. So how come you ended up in sales then?
Yeah, like many, I think a mistake, truthfully, or at least wasn't part of the plan. I originally was working in finance after college. wasn't very fulfilled by that after a couple of years. And a recruiter reached out to me who was really good at their job at the right time. And I said to her point blank, I'll never work in sales. But I was convinced by a really great team that hired me. And I figured if I was going to work really hard and wanted to feel like I could get value out of the time and energy I was putting into a company, regardless of things like how long I had been there, a lot of the red tape that you can get in more of the large corporate Americas that I did not enjoy. So I gave it a shot and loved it and haven't looked back since.
That's interesting. Your experience of finance is not something a lot of salespeople would have. How do you think that has helped you in your sales career?
I think there are a lot of skills, of course, that you can apply. It's good to be comfortable with numbers and be able to talk to ROI and business impact. But I think beyond that, it was interesting at the time, the company I became a BDR at was hiring a lot from finance. And I think they were finding a certain pedigree of people who end up there in terms of just being hyper competitive with themselves, having some flavor of professionalism and being able to work around hard deadlines and high expectations. So I think there was actually a pretty good parallel, and we saw a lot of success. In fact, most of my SDR class came from people who came from some type of finance role.
That's interesting that they would, they obviously saw something in it. I'm curious to know if when you're a BDR and you're on the phone with somebody and they say, we have no budget, and you're going, BS, I used to work at finance. I know exactly where the money is. I'm wondering if you ever had, does it give you that insight into where the money lies and how the money part of the process works?
I think it does. I haven't really drawn that parallel myself, but absolutely. I think at the end of the day, when it comes to budget, it's around priorities. So I think knowing that you can challenge back on, is this just not something that you want to prioritize today? Do you not see enough value for XYZ that we've laid out to want to make this the part of your budget that you're going to go and push for? So I definitely think getting more comfortable with qualifying earlier on and understanding we got to get to the money sooner. I think I probably sold to CFOs a lot sooner than a lot of other people because I knew at the end of the day they could rear their head at the end if we didn't have that budget conversation early on.
Yeah. What would you say that if one of your reps came to you, I came to you and I said, hey, boss, listen, I'd love to do business with them, but they told me they have no budget. What would that conversation sound like?
What day does that not happen? I think I've always been in an organization that's creating projects and maybe occasionally we have an RFP here or there, but it's very much us needing to go out and really pull that value out of them. So it's really going back to the discovery. What's the pain that we're trying to help them achieve? And typically when we get the no budget comment, we're either too low, we're with somebody who doesn't have the power, or we just frankly haven't done a good enough job doing our job and uncovering what the challenges are that we are well suited to help them overcome.
I know the one thing you didn't say was that it's got anything to do with budget or money.
You learn that pretty early on, I would say, or hopefully, if you're going to have a long career in sales, that's something you want to early on be comfortable saying BS on.
Speaking of early on, what were some of the early lessons that you learned that were a surprise to you where you went, I've never thought that sales is different? The pivotal moments.
Yeah, I definitely do think that there's a misconception out there, myself included, when I took that recruiter's call, that sellers are less intelligent and that they might be pushy and that they're sleazy. And I think early on, I met executives who were very intelligent, not in sales, who said, I could never do that job, and recognize that a sales profession is not for everyone and it's incredibly challenging and does require a lot of intellect. And I think just understanding that there were people out there that appreciated that and respected that in a weird way gave me the credibility that this is something that I could make a long-term career out of.
When you think about the people you've worked with, BDRs, AEs, people who were really successful and did the job really well and stood out, what were the kind of things that you observed, the common traits in them that you feel were pivotal in their success, including your own?
I think the ones that are incredibly successful have a very high level of humility. I think a lot of times there's a confidence and almost an ego or bravado that salespeople take on. And the good ones are quick to let that part come off of their facade and are looking at how can they improve, okay to admit that they were wrong and they want to learn. I think it's the ones that continue to have that front that only push with, I'm the one that knows what I'm doing, I have an idea, I have a game plan, and aren't so good at maybe reflecting on where they can get better or how they could learn from their losses, don't typically reach that potential that they could have of those that are more quick to say, I've got a lot to learn. This is not a game I ever win. It's always evolving and it's always a challenge that I'm chasing.
As a sales leader now, maybe you could share with us a little bit about the guiding principles and philosophies that guide you as a leader to create the kind of culture that supports that.
Hopefully I'm allowed to say this. I feel like because I'm Irish, I can get away with it this week, but don't be an asshole. That's just a principle in life that I try to live by. I believe fully that people buy from people. I've never been in an organization, thank goodness, that the sale ends at the contract and you hand it over and say good luck. Every job I've ever had has really been, even from a solution perspective, around enhancing the customer experience. And I think as sellers, like that is so important to have in the forefront of our mind. So early on, I'm working very closely with our customer success team, and it's known by my reps from day one that the expectation is we are a good partner to them so that our customers in the end see the full value that we are selling them and pitching them. And I think that's something that some organizations can lose track of because you're so focused on just your number. But in reality, we're all stakeholders in the business. And I think as you develop into leadership and kind of continue to move up the ladder, that becomes even more important of just the overall health of the business and the success and happiness of your customers.
Okay. As you moved from sales into sales leadership, what were some of the personal challenges you would have had in fitting into that role? What were you faced with?
The obvious, gender, obviously, is still something we're needing to fight and overcome. I think my first leadership call was me on a Zoom screen. We've always been a remote company, so even pre-COVID, we were on a lot of Zooms. And it was me and 12 guys, and they're all great, and they all are very respectful and appreciate me. But there's just certain things that you're not going to be able to replicate without having any other females there who can understand where you're coming from and my perspective. So I think that's something that was probably more underlying of what I needed to overcome.
Can you give us a few examples of that? You said there's some things that you would struggle to, I don't know, communicate. I can't remember the exact word you used, but maybe give us some detail on that. What are those things that you reckon, is it that the other people don't understand or don't resonate with?
I think it's more of kind of just the nature of your day-to-day conversations. I love sports, but like when you're on a call with 12 people and all you talk about is sports, sometimes you want to talk about news or cultural things that are happening in events, and you just tend to go to sports when there's 12 men on a call. And that's just a very easy example, but that can run through to everything from your hiring practices to your communication style to how you handle work-life balance. And so I just think not having the same diversity in terms of number of voices on a call can tend to sway where you're spending your time, how you're talking about things in a different manner. Men and women just have very different approaches and things when it comes to a lot of the topics that we're talking about on a leadership call. And so you got to find your voice and figure out how to make sure that your opinions are heard. And that's something that I'm continuously working on and improving as we as an organization are also looking at how do we hire more women? How do we promote from more within so that we're rounding out that leadership team? And it's been great to see us make advancements there, but I'd say across every company I've been at and the industry at whole, there's still a long way to go.
You said you grew up with a large family. I'm going to assume, tell me if I'm wrong, that there was boys and girls in that. How did you deal with those kind of things in those situations?
Yeah, we have a lot of strong females in our family. So my brother was actually pretty outnumbered. But I'd say early on, we didn't really have, again, we grew up on a baseball diamond and my dad coached both the girls and the guys. So I think we've always had a good sense of equality. I've always worked well with men. My parents tried to convince me to go into the military because they thought I'd be able to handle that going into finance. So I've always actually been a minority in my work scenario. I don't think that's something that defines me. That being said, I think that you do tend to mask some of what might naturally be your characteristics in order to blend in or feel kind of part of that team. And I think the older I get, the more I get into my leadership skills and find my own rhythm, it's important that it's my voice that's being heard and not the one that I think needs to be heard.
I think that we all mask elements of our own personality, our own thought process, our own attitudes when it comes to those group dynamics. And I'm wondering maybe if the conversation is around something superficial like sport. It could be other things, like politics can be very superficial too in terms of how it plays out in social discourse, that often that is a strategy where we can find some common ground. And I understand that kind of leads me full circle to your earlier point, but that at some level we are all masking something, because if we were all to blurt out exactly what we thought about who should be running the country or who should be running the company or who should be running a particular sales opportunity, that we'd have a meltdown very quickly, and therefore we need those strategies. And maybe what you're saying is it would be great, guys, if it was more than just sport.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think at some point, to be a professional and functioning adult, you need to mask probably some of what we want to say, especially this day and age. But I think to your point, yes, and the sports analogy is just a very frivolous one. But in general, I think needing to round out the other opinion. I'm somebody who thinks, using the example of politics, that you can't really make your opinions if you don't understand the other side of the coin. And I think it's actually very detrimental to only think and only talk to people who have the same opinions as you. And so where I think that women in leadership need to make sure their voice is being heard is simply making sure that people understand other ideas and other ways of going about a certain challenge, because that is what's going to make organizations better and help you innovate faster and get different talent in. Otherwise, it's talking to people who are just going to yes you and have the exact same kind of opinions and perception because of certain geographics and things that they've dealt with that are very similar to the rest of the team.
I wanted to just explore that a little bit further with you, because I'm wondering then is, okay, take the superficiality of small talk out of it, because I think that's easy to overcome. You mentioned about that there's maybe you feel not held back is the wrong word, but that there's something there where you feel there's another way of doing things, and that there's maybe a group think that is genderized somewhat by the fact that there's so many men that they think a particular way. And that, saying that females maybe have this is a huge generalization, but maybe a different approach to problem solving.
Yes, that's exactly it. And I think it's a different approach to a lot of things. Candidly, I think about how much in enterprise sales, traveling has become part of the norm. And that's just been the way it is. You go on site and you're always on the road. There's almost a badge of honor with the number of miles that you take. And early on, I had somebody, I think it was one of my chief legal counsels, call me and just ask why there weren't more women in sales. And she was just blown away when I explained to her how hard it is to live on the life on the road when you have a family at home and you are typically more of the caregiver for your kids. And that right there is something that I think COVID has helped a lot of people open their eyes to, that you can be really successful in enterprise sales and not be on the road every day of the week. Yes, there's still value. I think we're all antsy to get back in front of our clients. But I think that when majority of the leadership team are men and they maybe are not having to hold that role at home, then they are the ones creating that new norm that this is how we go about selling and you have to be on the road.
We'll come back to the working from home. I think there's something there to explore. But also when you put that point to, I'm assuming it was a male, you said he was blown away by it. Is it that you think they just don't think about it? Or here's what I'm asking, is when you put it to them, do you feel that you were understood and empathized with, and it was just a case of, look, we never ever thought about it, but man, this is not right?
The ironic thing is it was a female. And I think everyone in sales would think this is a pretty common reason. It's hard when women start to have families, for them to be on the road as much, that's not a secret. I just think that it's become such a norm. That is what you have to do to be successful in the role, that it's become accepted as almost a job qualification on your resume, that you are able to get on a plane 5 days a week. And I think for this female to understand, like, that was so important for you to be able to move up the chain in sales, that she was like, wow, no wonder so many women bow out before they get to that point.
And I guess what I'm wondering is that, because I hadn't thought of that, even though, because again, my wife and I would have had, she decided when my eldest child was born that she wanted to stay home and be the primary caregiver. Mm-hmm. And therefore you take that for granted as you continue along, and you just assume that part of your, like, my responsibilities from the kid's point of view is, I know there's always somebody there, and therefore I could forget and I can travel and do what I need to do. But if she were in the workforce, I could understand how easy it would be to just be blinkered and not see that. I'm wondering how people respond when it is pointed out to them. That's what I'm wondering, is to say, it was good. I never thought of that, but yeah. What could we do?
We talk about it more. It's still really surprising how many organizations, and I've worked at big organizations, I've worked at small organizations, the benefits can always run the gamut, but it's amazing we haven't standardized more around paternal leave when it comes to sales plans. That right there just, I think, says a lot about the fact that there haven't been more women in leadership roles forcing these conversations, that things like how long we're letting women in sales go out to have their families but feel like they have a safety net to come back to and don't feel like their job is on the line or going to be jeopardized if they decide that they
want
to do family.
Yeah, see, we have that here in Europe.
Oh, see, there you go. We have a long way to go here in the States.
But despite it, there's still, now it depends. If you look across Europe, so in Ireland, I can speak to that. I know it reasonably well, although it does change and it's evolving all the time. But for example, your job is guaranteed, I think, is it for up to a year? Now, you're not on full pay. You're on, there's an allowance, and most companies will top that up to full pay for a period of several weeks, maybe even some months. It depends. If you're in a public sector job, it's usually even longer. In Scandinavian countries, it's much more egalitarian. The issue we have here in Ireland is that I can get paternal leave. Sorry, not anymore. My kids are growing up, thankfully. But I can get paternal leave for a few days. But that's really just scratching the surface. I think it's maybe 2 weeks you can take, and that you're there when the baby comes home, which is, I know, is a particularly trying time, particularly if it's your first. And, you know, I remember my wife coming home, and here's the thing, we just don't think. I remember when my wife came home from hospital and we drove home, and at maybe 30 miles an hour the whole way. and of course, everybody on the road is an asshole driving too fast when that happens. But I had arranged for a few of our friends to be in the house. We were going to celebrate. And I never thought about what my wife was feeling in terms of how exhausted she went through an emergency cesarean, for God's sake. I know, please don't judge me. But you just don't think, and I think that's it. So I think, I'm wondering if awareness is 9/10 the battle here, and that you're pushing out an open door. It's just, there's a lack of awareness. You just don't think. The other part of the problem here is that you can take off as a woman, you can take off, I think it's at 6 months, and you're guaranteed your job back. And maybe a year, I can't remember. A man can't do that, not here. In Scandinavia, they can. And in fact, you're forced in some Scandinavian countries to take the leave. So it is much more, and it's at a year on full pay, I think. Yeah. So it's very different.
I think the same issue with needing to talk about it is needing to make it more clear for men that it's okay and, in fact, encouraged to take the full amount of time as well. I think in the States, a lot of companies have come far with making it an equal balance. So you might have a 3-month leave for any parent to take. And women obviously have to for a lot of biological and physical reasons. But I think a lot of men have this pride of, I'm only going to take a week and I'm going to come back to work because I'm in sales and I have a number and I need to hit. And I think as culture, yeah. And especially in the corporate world, we need to say, no, you need to take the time and be there for your family, because it's very much also helping your wife, who's probably trying to recover and get back to her job. It's got to be both sides of the coin, I think, to really make a change.
There's something else there as well that is not discussed at all, and I'll give you the male insight on it, is it's not so much the number to hit. That's probably an element of that. That would certainly be true if you were the only breadwinner in a house, but then it's not an issue at all because your partner is at home. But where there's both partners are working, there is a fear that if I don't show up, I'm going to be bypassed.
Yes.
And that's not just even maternity. A friend of mine who had very severe cancer and was out of the workforce, and was obviously had no choice in that instance. But he said his biggest fear at times wasn't the cancer. It was that he would be irrelevant in the workforce, that he would be passed over. And there's only a certain window that in your evolution going from sales to sales leadership. And if you miss out on that window, you lose out. And so there is a fear. And I think that's the issue that organizations need to address and build into their culture, is that it should be a badge of honor that you step out and step up rather than miss out, which is the fear.
I could not agree more. Unfortunately, I think just with now everyone being hyper on and always available, I think workaholics have really poured some gas on the fire in the last 18 months. But I think I have had a lot of conversations with colleagues and connections at other organizations, and I think conversations are starting to happen more and more. And we have a female vice president now in the Americas. Stuff like that is very encouraging, but we still have a ways to go.
Yeah, I noticed in France now, and they're looking at it here, is there is a right to your private space legislation, meaning that you cannot get emails from work after, let's say, I think it's 6 p.m. or something like that, which I think is a big thing as well. Yeah, so there's a few things. I don't like centralized kind of big government. However, I do think there's a role for them to step in situations like that, because you're right, being always on is then you're never off.
And then you're never on your peak, in my opinion. At some point, to your point, you got to reset. You got to step away, slow down.
Yeah, cool. So that's one speed bump along the way, and it's a big one. So there is the... You mentioned the, I think it will change when there's a critical mass. It doesn't have to be necessarily 50-50, but say if you had 10 in on the leadership team and there was 6 men and 4, or vice versa, it doesn't matter. There just needs to be a balanced, so therefore I've seen people suggest that it has to be 50-50, and maybe it does to get it there, but after that you have to just, when the faces are there and people have a role model, it becomes a whole lot easier, I think.
Yes, I agree. I don't know if it needs to be a 50-50 split. Again, I think normalizing that men too can take that time and do what they need to do to be a parental resource in their home. I think even things like that will just help swing how we're doing things into a more fair state, because there will be a more equal balance of kind of those expectations.
I wonder will working from home facilitate that as well? Sorry, remote working, I should say. Because before there was this pressure to be in the office at a certain time in the morning and not leave till well after closing time, and just that visibility was part of the identity. That's gone now, and maybe it'll free people up to be a lot more flexible. And so, you know what? I don't care when you show up so long as the work gets done.
And I'm optimistic about that. Yes, and I think the traveling piece will be interesting as well. Like when you are not around for a couple of days, it's very hard to understand what everything else at home is happening and how much time and attention that takes. But people have been forced to experience that. I think probably have a lot of appreciation for their other halves because of it takes a lot.
Yeah. I wonder also from a female perspective, if there's something in that might be helpful too. And where what I'm thinking of is I remember something I observed over many years is that when you work in a global organizations, if you want to get on, if you want to go up the ladder, you have to be visible. And I'll give you a perfect example. You probably won't be familiar with the geography, but when I worked in the UK, I worked in Motorola, And there was two offices outside London, one in a place called Slough, and another one was, I'm going to say maybe 20 miles, 30 miles away. It was a different division. And my boss's boss, who was the head of the division I was in, he was never physically there. He based himself in the other office because that's where the that's where the power line was. And it was clear what he was after. And now that's gone. So now it becomes an equalizer. And that visibility is no longer a key criteria, which was a big advantage to men that didn't have to be or didn't feel obliged, shall we say, to be at home when the kids got home from school or at dinner time or whatever else it is. They could afford to take the time out to play those political games. That's the old boys club. That's how it worked. That's no longer as relevant as it was. And I don't know that people want to go back to that. I'm curious about your own thoughts on it.
Yeah, I completely agree. In finance, my first manager was a female, still to this day, the only female manager I've had. And she had recently had a child. And I saw at 5 o'clock, she had to leave to go home and get her child from daycare. And that's almost when it felt like the boys club would start of let's go get drinks. And there was a whole focus on FaceTime and how often you sat around the office until your managing director was done and wanted to go get a drink. And I just, that's not my style. I'm not someone who thinks hours for hours' sake. That's why I loved sales, because my value was a direct output of the effort and time I put in, not just sitting around looking for that FaceTime and validation. I do think it'll change. However, I personally am of the mindset that the elastic is going to snap back sooner rather than later when it comes to travel and back into some of our routine, if you will. I don't think offices will come to be the same. I think that people will definitely be more flexible on where you work. In tech, I've always actually been in a very remote, so I haven't seen it as much as I think larger organizations that have that in-office mentality. But I'm optimistic that in some of those industries, that will be less important in the coming years. I don't know if I can project in decades that we will completely slide back to the old ways.
Sure. In terms of some of the other challenges in going from a sales role, you've heard it before that it's not necessarily the best salespeople make the best sales leaders.
Sure.
So there's obviously, it's a different job. And it requires a different skill set. And when you transitioned from sales into sales leadership, what were the areas you discovered where you needed to work on more? And what lessons did you learn from it?
Still one that I'm always working on and always open for tips is recruiting. I think that best leaders are those that hire people who are smarter than them and better at the job than they are. I think when I first started leading, you know what you're good at. You've been successful at doing something, so you want to replicate that. So you start to almost do the job of your team. You're micromanaging. You want everyone to do it yourself, and it's very easy to burn out, and even worse, just hold back your team for all of the great value that they can add in their own unique way. And part of that, obviously, is needing to figure out how you shift out of the weeds into coaching and enablement and helping them reach their potential. But I think also finding people that have skill sets that you don't have or bring, you know, I'm obviously very into having a diverse team and people that have unique backgrounds that are not necessarily the cookie cutter of what we've seen work, but figure out what they can bring and help all of us up our game and then help teach them some of the core processes and things that internally we know are going to make them wildly successful.
I'm curious about what you said about hiring people who are more intelligent. And I know you didn't mean that literally, because that's what do you mean by even an intelligent?
Yeah.
But, but smart, people who are smart and maybe have a different skill set. And as you think back to the managers you've had in your life or all the ones you've come across along the road, where ego interferes with that process, because intellectually you're absolutely spot on. If I can get people who are smarter or more skilled than I am, it actually means I have less work to do and I'll be more successful. However, there's an element that I've seen that where somebody doesn't, at a surface level, they'll say that, but then they don't really mean it because they feel threatened by somebody who's more skilled, that they might take their job or they may make them look bad. Or maybe they just don't have the skills to spot that in the first place. And I'm curious to know, as you, how true is that? Is that valid at all as an idea?
I definitely think that's valid for sure. I think in sales, I have a harder time with that argument because at the end of the day, you're almost, I almost think I'm not doing my job if I don't have reps on my team that are doing way more successful than I am. It's collectively, then that means that our team is doing better. I'm doing better. I'm elevating myself and our team. So to me, I think in sales, that's great. Go crush it. When it becomes a problem is if there's an ego there and you're butting heads when it comes to, again, fitting within our process. I think sales, it does come down to having a process that you can repeat that works for you. And I think that if your organization has one that they've invested in, built out, has proven it's worked, and you have somebody who comes in who's smart but has an ego and wants to bump against that, that's where there can be a lot of friction. But if someone comes in with the mentality of, hey, I know what I'm really good at, but I'm also eager to learn from you and I'm happy to understand what's made this company successful, what's made you successful, and give that a shot, then I think it can be a really a great relationship.
Mm. Where would you like to go next in your career?
So right now the focus is potentially IPO. I've yet to be along for that ride. I've been at companies just after and just before. So that's something I think would be fun to check the box on. Mm. I'm somebody who likes to set goals in 6 months and a year and then further out. I don't have a 5-year plan, but I do know long-term the idea.
Is that a Harley in the background?
Yeah. People are up and at it in Austin. Look at that.
Yeah. So are you in downtown Austin? You're not at the moment. No, you're...
I live about 10 minutes outside of downtown Austin.
Yeah, I have to say, when I was in Motorola, I had some very fun nights in 6th Street. And what
just
a place.
Last night with Mardi Gras. People were out and about.
Oh, stop. You're killing me. I'm curious to know, what was the name of the... There was this bar. I'm sorry, we'll get back to real conversation.
Nice.
But there was this bar, and I'm trying to remember what it was. It was something Joe's, or something Joe. And it was in the middle of 6th Street, but it had... There was no toilets. You had to go out the back. And in certainly in the men's, it was these broken ceramic urinals falling off a wall. And you were outside if it was raining. Obviously, it doesn't rain that much. But it was the diviest bar, but it was actually one of the best experiences I've had. And the beer wasn't on tap. It was only in bottles. And the blues music was just to die for. It was incredible.
Yeah, we're not known for our bathrooms, but we've got great live music.
Yeah, no, sure. Look, that particular place, and again, I'm going back to mid-90s, so it's a while ago. I'm sure maybe health and safety has come in since then and got them
I'm trying to think. There's so many that could fit that bill on East 6. Might not have lasted since then with all the UT students.
Yeah, for sure. Anyway, where are we going? Yeah, sorry, it was the bike I heard in the background. And we were talking about IPO, and I was interested to know how you see things changing for Sixth Sense after the IPO and what your life will be like after the IPO.
That's a great question. I think that I've been through enough companies and seen different exits to know that there is a cycle. I right now tell my team I want Sixth Sense to be the career highlight on their journey. So at this point, I'm really focused on that. I've been lucky enough to work with a lot of the leadership team here before. So there's definitely a lot of background, a lot of love, a lot of family here. So I don't know if hopefully I would have the chance to work with some of them again and figure out what our next adventure would be and maybe have a different outcome on that one. But I think at the end of the day, what makes work so enjoyable is the people. And so as long as I continue to get to work with good people and find ways to solve new challenges, I think I'll feel fulfilled.
The IPO is obviously going to bring in a lot more money to the company. I'm not going to ask you what you would recommend to the people running that show, but if you had that kind of money in the organization, what would you do with it? Where would you spend it? Where would you invest it?
I think there's a lot we can do before the IPO and will do. I think that it's important to look at all the legs of the stool and not think about how to over-index. I've seen companies that just go in and double or triple their sales force. And while that might help the top line, that has other impacts when it comes to your support and your product and all of that. So someone above my pay grade definitely will be making these decisions and has done them before and knows what they're doing. I think that there's a lot of opportunity for us to really double down on what we're doing well and move the needle in ways that the industry has not seen versus others in the industry that right now might just look at how do we kind of tack on different acquisitions to build a bigger platform. I think that there's interest in going that way, and I understand why you would, but it's hard to be a jack of all and master of none. And I think we've got some secret sauce in what we do really well that we could really pour some gas on the fire and see what happens in the next couple of years.
And in reality, it doesn't have to change all that much, because IPOs are just often, they're just there for the investors can get their money out. But the organization itself can stay on the same path. It doesn't have to go crazy with money it's raised.
There's still a lot that can happen before then that might change the outcome of that. But I think that we're just starting to see a real appetite for doing sales and marketing in a different manner. I think that's something that's always excited me about Sixth Sense in this space, is how can we be smarter with the data we have? How can we learn what our sisters and brothers in B2C have already done when it comes to personalization and automation, and put some of the fun back into the B2B buying experience? At the end of the day, again, it's, we buy from people. We don't need to think of it as these leads that don't have a personality and are just an email address. So I think that we're just getting started, and an IPO can certainly bring more money and visibility to that, but it won't really change, I think, the mission that we're here to.
I hope they're listening to you, because you're a rocket science, Maura, for sure. It's been a great pleasure talking to you. I'm just conscious we are up against the time, and I want to respect that. Final question for you. I ask all my guests the same question. It's this: when the time comes and you depart this life to whatever comes next, and there is a book written about your life, what would the title of that book be?
It would probably be, which is not the most apt for my passing, but You Can Sleep When You're Dead. I've always liked that saying. I think there's a lot in this life that we can get out of it, and I wouldn't want to be napping through it. So I try to make the most of my days, and hopefully my memoir would reflect that.
I actually think you've also given me the title for this podcast.
Perfect. That would be an honor.
I absolutely love it. You can sleep when you're dead.
Yep.
That's it. Yeah, you can sleep when you're dead. Plenty of time for that. Maura Brady, thank you so much for being my guest today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Paul. I appreciate it.